Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. Well, it was good enough for my grandpa. It was good enough for my grandpa. That was good enough for my grandpa. That's good enough for me.
Sometimes our dreams go unfulfilled. Now hang on just a minute. This actually isn't headed towards some grand sweeping insight into anything. It's much less exotic. Nerdy, even. Mr. Brian over here was very excited for the journals of George F. Richards to be published online. Technically, he's mid-excitement since they're still coming out. Slowly but surely. When they did publish the first part, he was rewarded with these actual entries. Monday. Put my plow together and plowed in the afternoon with one team. Tuesday. Started plowing with three animals. Wrote home. Wednesday. Plowed all day. Thursday. Ditto, 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 ditto. Yeah, you heard it right. George's day was so sexy that he just had to put four double quotes, meaning I did the exact same GD thing I did yesterday.
It's true. I'll have you know, I still read every word, though. I joked with friend of the podcast, Rob Jensen, that if ever an expert on lucerne farming in Tooele is needed, I can now qualify. These are the sacrifices we make for you listeners. What did Brian Adams say? Your underwear. Ugh, no. Try again, you hoser. Everything I do it for you. There we go. Really appreciate you spelling your name the correct way also, guy. Here's the deal. Everyday life isn't always full of councils of 50 or anointed quorums or even cracker soup. That's why they call it everyday life. So then, what did it look like in winter quarters? What was your average Leonora or Louisa up to?
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Hold on to your Curaloms and Q-Moms for just a second, though, because first, we need to hear from our friends' signature books. George Q. Cannon is generally acknowledged as second only to Brigham Young as the most visible leader of Mormonism in the mid to late 19th century. He became Young's protege and was an influential first counselor in the first presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for almost 25 years, serving with Presidents Brigham Young, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, and Lorenzo Snow. Known as the spokesman for the kingdom, Cannon was the central political figure of the church, not only serving as Utah's territory's delegate to Congress for 10 years, but also as chief political advisor and long-term editor of the Deseret News. Cannon helped shape doctrine, church governance, and administration during a period of significant change, defending and promulgating plural marriage both before and after the 1890 Manifesto. He was at the center of business life in Salt Lake City, serving as president of the largest publishing house, banks, a railroad, mining companies, electric companies, and other businesses. Though Cannon was loved and revered by his people, controversy sometimes touched his life and family. George Q. Cannon, Politician, Publisher, Apostle of Polygamy by Ken Cannon, new from Signature Books. Get it at Benchmark Books or be forced to wear a neck beard for time and all eternity. Daily life in winter quarters, eh? I accept your challenge. Now, we do need to remind ourselves of one thing right here. Because winter quarters is at the same time a place, it's the main camp, but we also use it as a relative term for this transitional period. The winter quarters period involves several way stations, and a lot of what we think of as winter quarters is actually traveling from one of those places to the next. As a result, this episode and the next will kind of blend together. Okay. Let's set some ground rules for today. We're going to do our most bestest to narrate things from the perspective of women. It's not going to be particularly easy because there aren't a ton of available diaries, certainly not published, and not even unpublished ones. Well, we never said it was going to be easy. We only said it would be worth it. Game on. As the Mormons leave Nauvoo, remember, it's still winter. This isn't Oregon Trail winter on an orange or green screen on a Mac in the computer room. This is the real thing. They're in wagons or tents, and Gore-Tex is just a twinkle in Wilbert Gore's eye in the spirit world. You might not be a big city wagon or even tent expert, but I think you can imagine in your mind's eye when I say it, there's not a lot of room in either of those. Eliza Partridge, who won the post-Joseph Smith lottery by marrying Amasa Lyman rather than, say, Heber Kimball, noted they had three of them in one bed due to those aforementioned space concerns. Not like the William Clayton program, smart guy. They're just kind of mushed into one bed.
Eliza unwedged herself from the bed and walked over to her sister Emily's to see how she was doing. I mean, she's now married to Brigham Young, so you have to check in on her. That's a good indicator. But I digress. When Eliza arrived, she described Emily's tent being surrounded by mud. That would be a, let's say, a common theme for the next few years. A very obnoxious element of their experience in the middle of nowhere is the fact that stomachs, famously, do not care where you are. They are still growly and angry if you don't feed them, even in the wilderness. So within the space of one day, Eliza describes how they ate cold meat and bread before bed one night, then woke up and made a bark fire to get their morning coffee. Sorry, did I say coffee? Yeah, if your ears get itchy with word of wisdom talk, look out, because no coffee was definitely not a thing yet, especially during the long trek to Utah. So yes, they were drinking coffee. However, the same day, Amasa Lyman and company took a break from the seance table and went hunting, bringing back rabbits, prairie hens, and a bird. And that's a joke which will be a lot funnier in about 20 years, meaning 20 years in their time, even though it legitimately feels like sometimes it will take us that long to get there.
Hang down your head now, what have you done? Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head now, what have you done? It's time to say goodbye. Hang down your head now, what have you done? Hang down your head and cry.
We could go on discussing the mess of squirrels they would soon catch, because sometimes people wouldn't eat enough squirrel mess to satisfy their picky nutritionist. Or maybe precisely because they did eat squirrel mess, they died. What's interesting is this is the first time we hear about people being buried in their garments or priestly robes. One particularly fascinating account comes from John D. Lee. Sorry, I know we broke the rules. He's definitely a dude. He tells us about one guy who requested to be buried in the temple robes, even though he hadn't received the endowment in Nauvoo. So they consult Isaac Morley, who, oddly enough, ruled that, quote, certainly his friend would be passed through those ordinances, so he allowed it. And sometimes people didn't actually die, they just kind of wished they could. Eliza describes one week where it rained almost every day. Now remember, they have to cook outdoors, which, historically, is really difficult while it's raining. Fire thinks it's so tough, except when it's fighting rain, then it cowers in the corner like the lamest WWF guy in history. One day, they finally got a fire going to try and dry off, but it just kept raining. They give up, and they just try to sleep in the wagons. Eliza, who still has some gallows humor with her, summarized, quote, "I do not know why I did not freeze, for I had no bed and very little covering. It must be that there was not room in the wagon for the frost to get in. It was so full of folks." I gotta say, one of my kids went on Rattlesnake Rapids twice in a row. She got so wet, she thought her life was the absolute worst. Eliza is shaking her head somewhere.
These muddy Mormons had to pick their spot carefully if they wanted any fun. They got one day without rain and decided to make hay. Metaphorical hay. Eliza tells us how Brother Edwards was sick, and then in the next breath, quote, "the rest of our men preparing for a game of ball." Little did they know that Eliza was actually batting 375 that season and should have been the first one picked. Look at you, Brian. A baseball joke. I'm very proud of you.
I threw up three times in my mouth writing that joke. Remember, kids. Everything
part of their life was trying to learn the names of all the places they were passing by. One day, going 16 miles by sundown, they passed what Eliza called the Nishnabotany River. For the record, it's the Nishnabotany River. Girl, I see you. I say things wrong too all the time.
Then, completely out of left field, Eliza drops this, quote, "my first child was born." There was absolutely no prelude music for this, not a hint. And the thing is, babies are like unto those hungry tummies. They really don't care at all where you are. Oh, you've just had to put bridges over some mud holes because they were that bad. Tough molasses, Mom. I'm about to crown here, sucka.
Given, you know, basically everything we've mentioned so far, you can assume that it was not a clean, softly lit hospital with a killer snack room. Nope, it was mud, mud, and then also some more mud. Eliza, who wasn't a complainer, wrote plainly, quote, "I am very uncomfortably situated for a sick woman. The scorching sun shining upon the wagon through the day and the cool air at night is almost too much of a change to be healthy." And for the record, it was July 14th. And then her hair started falling out. Girl, again, I see you.
Their days really could be filled with anything. Do you remember as a kid those cool books with a spiral binding where you'd switch up the halves of the person? Oh, how droll, he's wearing a suit coat with shorts. Isn't that droll? You know how kids talk. That's what those mud-encrusted Mormons would do. Let's see, today we're going to start the top half with baked goose for supper. Flip, flip, flip. Let's pair that with the cry that a mob was near. What a droll combo. You know how nothing gets the juices flowing in Mormon town like mobs and rumors of mobs.
This next section. Eliza went from one entry on the new little guy who had just gained 2 pounds and was a great comfort to Mom the next day where he cried all day. A week later, he was gone. Now you can see Brian doesn't like dead babies. You can feel Eliza's resignation and grief as she records, quote, "We have done the best we knew how for him, but nothing has done any good." Between a mother who is so undernourished that her hair is falling out to rampant non-sanitation to the old fighting mosquitoes, it's a wonder that anyone survived to earn the reward of singing as they walked and walked and walked.
No, thank you. Babies, please stay alive. Quote, "We could not bear to part with him, but we were powerless. I said, no, thank you. He is gone and I cannot recall him." Ooh, babies, come back. Ugh, can we shift gears here? Sister Spicer died, leaving 2 small children to the care of her sister. No, that doesn't count. Sister Elvira Holmes' babe died. People, you're not picking up when I'm laying down. All right, listen, I'm going to go to another source if I need to. And friends, let me give you a hint of how difficult it was to find something entertaining to talk about. I finally had to give up and just go to bed. Next day, I finally found something. You know why I did all this?
Everything I do. Do it for you.
All right, Mr. Brian Adams, I think we've had about enough of you for today. All right, remember our friend, Mary Haskin Parker Richards, from a couple episodes ago? She wrote a letter to her husband in England to tell him a little something about his Mary. I have to say, her referring to herself in the third person, that's just great. I enjoyed it. She explained, "The last night she went to singing school and behaved herself pretty well till after they got through singing, and then if you could only have seen her a-scouring that floor, she was dancing almost every figure and a-mixing round at a great rate." There we go. Something fun.
Are you going to tell the nice people out there that she had to dance with Brigham Young that same night? And when they finished, he told her this line, "Sister Mary, you have learned me."
I said no thank you.
No game. Fine, let's move on to Lucy Meserve. Is that right?
Sure.
Meserve? Someone out there will tell us that we've got their ancestor's name wrong. Just learned the other day that it's Fanny Alger.
Alger.
Alger. Fanny Alger. Ugh. Everyone correct it. We have been officially corrected by a descendant, Fanny Alger.
We were put on notice.
Anyway, back to Lucy Meserve and her account. She was married to George A. Smith. No word on whether she was the wigmaster in the house. Her record spells Mount Pisgah with a Z, so that alone makes her cool. Pisgah. Very Snoop Dogg of you. And no one is around to correct her pronunciation either. Her coolness would not make the whole place shimmer on her 30th birthday, however. We have to pause for a tiny tangent first. Here's the thing. Eating a mess of squirrels and maybe some bread and occasionally some milk, emphasis on occasionally, will eventually land you squarely in Scurvy Town. Yep, scurvy. It's not just for sailors anymore. It's caused by massive vitamin C deficiency, and it's not pretty. Bleeding gums, bleeding under the skin, sometimes bleeding outside the skin. So back to Lucy. Her Burgundy birthday started with her fancy meal of a little cornmeal gruel, and she told her family she would always remember that crappy birthday dinner. Soon after that, she was so bad off she could barely get up on one elbow when, just a warning here, this is going to get pretty gnarly, she started bleeding from her nose and throat, and she described it as a stream the size of a knitting needle. Just then, quote, a strange woman came in and told her how to stop the bleeding, and I have to admit, we definitely don't hear enough Three Nephitesses stories.
Oh, Lucy would have more visitations. She reported being visited by a grim old man, but she knew he was a bad spirit.
Because?
Obviously, he was wearing all white except for a black tie. So don't you go to any more of those fancy corporate parties. All evil spirits there. Oh, and one other time, she heard a choir of three voices singing what she called an anthem, and they were singing all in unison. And in case you're still on the fence about where I'm headed with all this, yeah, her baby also died. She then immediately went to take care of another woman until that woman died, so then she took over caring for that lady's baby. So occasionally, you hear about the death toll in winter quarters, but it's way worse than you're imagining. Those couple years were absolutely brutal, particularly on babies and children.
I did not know that scurvy made you see ghosts. That is interesting.
Apparently.
Eat your fruits and veggies, friends.
Unless you like them visions.
Unless you like them birthday cornmeal visions. So the settlement at Canesville was becoming a town of its own, and sometimes we forget that they weren't totally isolated, though, because Lucy talks about teaching at the Mormon school there in the settlement, but then went to nearby Bellevue and taught at the Pawnee Mission School for 6 months. There weren't many opportunities to make money in this area because it was still pretty isolated, and there wasn't a lot of opportunity to get room and board, so they had to take advantage of anything that came up. Their neighbors weren't always human. No, not zombies, you weirdo. I'm talking about snakes, obviously. Once they got to Mount Pisgah, we get a great report from a woman with easily one of the best names in Mormon history, Sarah D'Armond P. Sarah D'Armond P. That's a Bart Simpson name. Sarah informs us that the snakes there were bad. How bad? Very bad. Very with two R's bad. So you know she's serious. They bit the cattle and horses, and Sarah even wrote, quote, "It was no uncommon thing to find snakes coiled up under our beds when we took them up in our tent in the morning."
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
You know who needs to be heard from now? Leonora Cannon, that's who. Her journal is mostly just facts, ma'am, but she does give us some pretty interesting gems. It's likely tied directly to the fact that I was super hungry when I was reading her journal, but her description of the dinner they had on this cold day, no less, of artichokes with potatoes and onions sounded amazing.
I mean, I DoorDash that, no questions asked, even from their, you know, homemade skillet in winter quarters.
I'm agreed, as long as
coming in from Iowa.
Out of it. Artichokes, that was just a fun touch. Some days, however, it wasn't quite so culinary. I laughed when I read one day they feasted on breakfast of illegible. I have to think that's not coincidental. I imagine they had quite a few days of fried illegible. Hold on, though, because we have breaking news for you. We have found another precious gem of fun in the middle of squirrel mess and bitey snakes. Leonora wrote that one day her husband, Mr. John Taylor, and another guy threw quoits. I found that very entertaining. Taylor was a big fan of this game.
What is that?
Quoits is like ring toss, basically. It was like a stake in the ground, and then I would guess they'd probably make it out of rope and make a circle out of it and then play a ring toss.
It's like horseshoes, but dumber.
Excuse me?
Yeah, okay.
You're going to tell John Taylor that when you meet him?
Oh, no. I've got other things to talk to him about.
Fair enough. See, I found this fun because when he and George the Neckbeard Cannon, who is also Leonora's nephew, find themselves on the underground for polygamy 40 years later, guess what they played every day? Quoits. Yeah. It's not super exotic, sure, but, you know, River City Ransom hasn't even been invented yet, so you make do with what you have.
Who do you think won? Who do you think was better, Woodruff or Taylor? Does that depend on where you position yourself in the restoration now?
Maybe.
Like, maybe Woodruff's wasn't a legitimate toss.
I don't want to hear from anyone who says that Lauren Woolley never lost at quoits, because I'm not going to believe you.
Quoits does sound like what pioneers would call their bowel complaints from eating too much squirrel mess.
I had too much squirrel mess. I got the quoits again.
Got the quoits again. I enjoy that Lenora also took a stab at spelling the GD Nishnabotna River with Visni Botany. Good try, lady. She got Potawatomis, no problem. So I suppose
Potawatomis.
She got Potawatomis. She got Potawatomis, no problem. So I suppose I can't give her any grief. Even their day-to-day life was infused with memories of persecution. When June 27th, 1846 rolled around, no one forgot to look at the calendar. Lenora noted that, quote, "This day 2 years since, poor brother Joseph and Hiram were murdered and father shot almost to death." Father. By father, she means husband.
Daddy.
Daddy. Old sugar daddy Quoits Taylor himself. 2 days later, Willard Richards wasn't done commemorating and told about bringing the bodies back to Nauvoo. I'm sure that's what he focused on. Not the fact he was hiding under the bed the whole time. Like a coward. I will take the high road here and not comment on any other reasons on why he might have been in one piece and therefore able to bring those bodies back.
Except that you did comment on it.
I didn't even talk about him hiding behind the door like a little baby. You know who didn't? Old Quoits himself, John Taylor.
That's why he gets to be called Daddy.
You know what? I've got to say, like, he was shot up, right? I think about this all the time. John Taylor was really shot up in the martyrdom. But 2 years later, he's traveling to England, just gallivanting around with all those bullet holes, still recovering. 2 years is not a lot of time to recover from gunshot wounds.
Multiple gunshot wounds, like serious ones.
Do you think he, like, showed them to all the converts?
I mean, we have records. Like, my favorite one is in Utah. I think Brigham is talking, and the report of it just has John Taylor kind of sitting behind him saying, "I can feel the bullets in me yet."
Oh, gosh. Do you think Willard Richards could do that? Do you think he could sit around and, oh, wait.
I know what the back of the door looked like. I can tell you the pattern of the door. Is that faith promoting? All right, fine. I'll salute your high-roadedness here. Leonora, of course, reported on health and wellness like every single other diary at the time. She had a bad knee, which, being in my 40s now, seems very accusatory in my direction. Among other things, she tried powdered deer's horn for her knee, and that was definitely not the only journal I read that reported that cure. One of the more disturbing entries discussed Sister Mitchell, who she described as quite crazy. Leonora went to get Brigham Young's opinion. He prescribed a baptism for health. Leonora also had what was perhaps the best one-day food haul in all of Winter Quarters lore. Check it out. Onions, potatoes, apples, raisins, cake and beer, Lucy Mack is nodding approvingly, a barrel of grapes, and then some hops. Listen, I'd go hang out at the Taylor house.
Can someone send that back to Lucy? And because her nose is bleeding all over her cornmeal birthday cake.
She's like, can I have one of those things? Just
one. Take an onion.
You can pick which one.
As you might imagine, in a society not known for being lit very often, visitors were kind of a big deal. So obviously people in all these little settlements would comment on when the Brighams and the Hebers of the world popped in. And if they preached, well, that was front page news. Not surprisingly, the call for soldiers that would make up the Mormon Battalion was about the biggest news of them all. And you would also get some more, I don't know, colorful visitors. Porter Rockwell showing up certainly didn't go unnoticed, wandering around yelling, "Does anyone want to play Little Burn Boggs in the living room?" Too soon? I mean, even Porter wasn't there. He's running away crying like a baby.
That was, I've already pitched Lee Nelson books, but let's just do it again. I honestly thought his book about Porter Rockwell was fantastic.
Tiny little white dog on the back of his horse, running around crying about his boyfriend, Joseph Smith.
It really, like, it. He paints him as a much more emotional person.
He cried all the time.
He really did.
He cried and then he murdered kids and didn't think anything of it, but...
You don't get a lot of reports of later Porter crying too much. It's hard to find time when you're shooting everyone, but...
I bet he cried every June 27th.
And I gotta say, I really love the little hints of snark that seep into these journals because they're usually so few and far between that they really stick out. Leonora may not have been getting enough squirrel mess at dinner, but her tongue, or more accurately, her quill, had not lost its edge. In October 1846, Almon Babbitt dragged his butt into the camp. We haven't talked about him too much yet, but suffice it to say, he'd have fit in pretty well with the Smash Brothers back in Boston. Not so much the pants-off conduct, but the general being an a-hole. Listen to how Leonora described his grand entry. Elder Babbitt here, full of himself and all that he is famous for.
I love it. It's not a coincidence when he gets himself killed later. Oops, I said the quiet part out loud. Please kindly disregard. I'm just crapping on everybody's ancestors today. However, Babbitt did bring her a letter from John Taylor, who was in England at the time, so I'm guessing she dialed back the snark at least a teensy bit. It was John Taylor's birthday the next day, so that was even more bittersweet. And if you're curious if the ladies also did visiting from camp to camp, obviously they did. The thing with journals is that you often have to get to read things into it. Lenora one night mentions that a certain Sister Smith was on a visit. Not one of these store brand Smiths either. Sister Hiram Smith arrived. There are some things about Mormon society in Winter Quarters that we can't really be too definite about, but we can safely say that the fact that Sister Hiram Smith was in their midst and Sister Joseph Smith was most certainly not was always in the back of their minds.
He shunned me, Alice Angel fell. Doesn't want me in heaven, won't send me to hell. Then I think I'd stay here. Well, I'm gonna be blunt. They can keep his eternity, cause that dog won't hunt. My prayers won't be answered. Salvation is gone. I'm
left. It's now time to rekindle our visit with an old friend, Louisa Barnes Pratt. Remember, way back when people still used Twitter, and to a lesser extent, Facebook, back to a time when we talked about Mormons and French Polynesia. We talked a little bit about Addison Pratt, who eventually let all those hammocks and pina coladas sour him on Mormonism. And we mentioned then that his wife Louisa was probably even more interesting, and we would talk about her in the future. The future is now. And, coincidentally, female. Part of the journey of reading a whole bunch of these contemporary journals back to back is you get to see how different they are. Not that you would know anything about that, Lindsay.
Yeah, because I definitely haven't done that 87 times while working on Juanita, you know, reading all the journals. And
just like they did, like when you read a whole bunch of different journals about the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, as we're going to talk about the Overland Trail coming up, I was comparing the journals of people who went on the same journey, and they'll have a lot of repeats. But one of the frustrating things, and we'll talk about this in an upcoming episode, is no one can actually know when Pioneer Day should happen. Like, not even historians. Who was there, what day it was. And I get it. You're on the trail for 75 days. Maybe they all will start blending together. You don't know what day is what. But that's funny. And then the best part is seeing how different people talk about indelicate things that happened. Some just go into it, and some are more careful, and leaders of the church are more careful about what they write, but you'll get like somebody on the ground that doesn't realize that they can't talk about that, and they talk about them in their memoirs. And that's why Juanita's papers are the best. All the salt.
So you read some of these diaries and they're just very bare bones. These are the journals that will tell you on a date, you know, something cool happened, went to meeting, heard good doctrine preached. What? What did you hear at this meeting? Filthy no details person. Lindsay is going to go all Aunt Piggy's privy on you.
Seriously, we hate this. When they're talking about sermons, big sermons, like then I send Brian midnight emails being like, hey, you got to help me find this.
We find the actual text of the sermon or at least a decent report of it.
And then we have to cross compare the journals because there's not. And it's weird too, because when they're not recording word for word, some interpret it differently. And that's always fun.
Okay, we're calm again. Louise's writing is, however, fantastic. Listen to this description of going to bed, something that any parent can tell you feels like the Twilight Zone night after night after night. Quote, no signs of rain till we were all locked in the arms of Morpheus. Then suddenly loud thunder began to roar. Fierce lightning flashed. Arms of Morpheus. It was such a good touch. It immediately brought to mind visions of downloading MP3s circa 2002.
If this were ice skating, the next snippet would be called a triple Katie Rich. When they make formal camp, Louisa notes with scorn, quote, the brethren met by themselves, organized, and chose a president without the aid or counsel of the women. This evening, the sisters propose to organize themselves into a distinct body to prove to the men that we are competent to govern ourselves. If they set the example of separate interests, we must carry it out. Oh, so good. I like that because at first when you read that, the brethren, you know, go off and meet by themselves. I'm like, get used to that, sister. But her thing of like, no, we're gonna organize ourselves. For women who aren't supposed to be acting officially for another 20 years, that last paragraph sounded pretty, I don't know, not unofficial. Votes, resolutions being made, yeah, nothing about that is super formal. That backs up Katie Ludlow Rich's thesis. Okay, sorry, one last thing about their meeting. Listen to these resolutions. Quote, first, resolved that when the brethren call on us to attend prayers, get engaged in conversation, and forget what they called us for, that the sisters retire to some convenient place, pray by themselves, and go about their business. Smart. Every girls' camp director out there should be paying attention to this. Second, if the men wish to hold control over women, let them be on the alert. We believe in equal rights. It's immediately clear from Louise's record that she did not model how to keep sweet very well. One day, while trying to get the whole camp from one place to the next, a young man whom the girls have named Greenhorn drives his wagon right in the mud hole and snaps his axle. This, of course, halts all the progress for the day until all the Brigham's horses and all the Brigham's men could put Mr. Sucks at Driving back together again. Louisa's oldest daughter immediately tells him, quote, had your head been right side up, you might have saved us all this delay. Ouch, she's so salty.
Louisa's journal, which I think you can already see is just a whole lot of fun, reports on her own cows, which actually do keep sweet. Unlike another cow in camp, which is apparently, quote, not a Mormon, she has nothing of a gathering spirit, seems determined to go back. I love how she describes.
That's the cow.
Cows.
The cow is determined to go by.
No
gathering spirit.
No gathering
huh?
spirit in that cow. So while they're fixing Mr. Greenhorn's busted axle, one of Louisa's cows had a baby, and the kids were delighted because they got to carry the little guy in the wagon with them for a few days.
Louisa's record of day-to-day life might just be my favorite. She does such a good job of showing how the mundane melded with the brief flashes of pleasure. Just a few lines after struggling through a 3-mile mud hole, she describes how, quote, Sister Eldridge and myself have had a long ride on horseback, taking a view of the country and admiring it. Another element of Louisa's writing that makes it so engaging is when she turns introspective. As she's writing out, she realizes that while, quote, sometimes I feel cheerful, again it comes suddenly to my mind how far I am going from my home, parents, and every relative I have in the world. But the Lord has called us and appointed us a place where we can live in peace and be free from the dread of our cruel persecutors. We often miss out on the emotional component of this journey. These were real people going through a really wrenching and frequently traumatic journey. Then immediately, Louisa remembers to write down how, the previous night, around the fire, a younger guy who they called Captain, quote, dressed in woman's attire, danced to amuse us. We can't have men dressing in women's clothes. What will we do?
We didn't do that in the 19th century. We don't do that now.
Back to the quote. Several in the crowd did not know who it was, thought it was some strange lady who had come in from another company.
Nothing escaped Louisa's attention. She described the very welcome shade trees at Mount Pisgah, and then noted how a few of them had been used to make the post office. Quote, a little log pen, 10x8, covered with bark. Not even the humble little post office could withstand her snarky pen. She called it laughable. It's just savage. And of course, she commented on the weather. One day, they're struggling to keep their tents from blowing away, and Louisa waxed descriptive again. The elements are in great commotion, and my mind is dark and dismal. I think, what if we have to wander 40 years in the wilderness as the children of Israel did?
Well, they didn't have to wander quite that much. Sorry, Louisa. There is definitely a healthy amount left to wander. Never forget, however, that pioneer children sang as they wandered and wandered and wandered.
I'm so happy, because today I found my Books of Mormon's reports. They're in my head. Powered by Benchmark Books. We definitely need to do some more work publishing Mormon women's accounts. But you know who you can't blame for that? Carol Cornwall Madsen. Her long, long career has been devoted to this. Proud report, she's still kicking in her early 90s. Got to see her just a couple weeks ago. So as part of the sesquicentennial celebrations in 97... she published an edited collection of first-hand accounts of the journey to Utah called Journey to Zion, Voices from the Mormon Trail. And a lot of the characters from this episode come from this compilation. Yes, it was published by Deseret Book, but as you saw, sometimes those women's accounts were spicy. You know, like normal life sometimes is. Get this and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com.
And this weekend, Brian and I are at the Sunstone Symposium happening in Salt Lake City, Utah. If you're in Salt Lake, come on over to the Mountain America Expo Center. We're going to be here Friday and Saturday. And if not, don't you worry. We are launching our digital symposium on August 15th. And what that means is starting August 15th, 2023, you can purchase any of the audio sessions for download for a small fee, and all the proceeds go to sunstone.org. So make sure you mark your calendars for August 15th. Buy a bunch of sessions, including mine and Brian's. We'll be presenting there as well. And leave us a donation at sunstone.org and give us a 5-star review on iTunes.
Brother Young.
spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, brother Young. Let only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.